Now, our panel this morning: John Bruton, former Taoiseach; Sinead O'Carroll, editor of the Journal.ie; Suzanne Lynch, Washington correspondent with the Irish Times; Jim Power, economist; and Kevin Doyle, group political editor of Independent News and Media. Guys, you're all very welcome. Good morning. John Bruton, looking at all that, where are we at? What's your thinking at this stage?
Well, it looks as if Boris Johnson is actually working towards a no deal rather than towards a deal. Apart from the evidence put forward by Amber Rudd, which you quoted earlier, when Theresa May was in office, there were 100 people working with her negotiator, 100 staff. That's now been slashed to 24 people working with the current negotiator, Mr. Frost, who's supposedly trying to negotiate. But that indicates that the priorities of the government in the UK are not to get a deal. It's to get to a no-deal situation.
Where do you see it going from here?
The problem, I think, is that it's very difficult to see how the current House of Commons can agree on any solution. I don't think it could agree on a new referendum. I don't think it could or would agree on withdrawing the Article 50 letter. But equally, I don't see any conceivable deal that it could vote in majority for. So in a sense, we have a House of Commons that's paralysed. And in that sense, a general election might clear the air. And that is something that we will have to face. The question will be, when does it take place and in what circumstances? Will the parties that favour Britain having either a soft Brexit or remaining in the European Union, will they be able to coordinate their forces under the British electoral system?
They were able to do this in Parliament quite effectively last week, but it's a different job to try and do it across the country. But there is talk of that the Remain coalition are going to set up a national network where they're going to start advising people which Remain candidate has a chance, and that they're going to bombard people saying vote for this Remain candidate. But it seems unlikely, doesn't it, that they would manage to coordinate to that extent?
Well, they'll have to get the consent to some degree, at least, of the local local parties. And, you will have situations where, for example, a Liberal Democrat who came within 2% of winning the seat the last time is being asked to withdraw in favour of a pro-Remain Tory.
Politics a long time. Could you see that happen? And even more competition here between people in their own parties. Can you see anyone backing down and saying, you go ahead for the good of the country?
Yes, I can, actually. I think the issue is now so polarised and so serious, and people are so exercised about it, that anyone who either side of the argument put their own political personal interests ahead of the interests of the cause, either of Remain or Leave, would be punished by the respective electorate that supports them. So I think there will be a lot of pressure on both sides. I think the Brexit Party and the Tories may well also have some sort of an electoral arrangement, which will mean a very deeply divisive election.
But what it means as well is that if you're rerunning the referendum, but the winner this time really only has to get, you could win with 35%.
Yes.
So if you're rerunning a referendum, that's easier for the Brexiteers, for whom no deal is now kind of the standard when it was regarded as madness originally. You're rerunning that referendum with a better chance of yes. Brexiteers winning, and a better chance that no deal would be viewed as the natural outcome. Are you despairing about it then?
No, I think there has been some shift in opinion towards Remain, but not very much. And I think a lot of people have been assuming, as I think they have been in this country too, that it'll all turn out right on the night, and they haven't really addressed themselves to the disruptive effects of a no-deal Brexit. And I think as the campaign starts, and as people begin to immerse themselves in the detail of what a no-deal Brexit might mean, and also what no deal might mean in the long term, because there will be short term and long term effects.
This will
not end the debate.
But Dominic Cummings is betting that people are not going to immerse themselves in the detail of what no deal means, and that this will be an election fought by Boris Johnson on one side saying, I'll deliver Brexit, I'll give you what you want, and a coalition of the willing on the other side who are Some of them still unsure where they stand on Brexit. Sinead O'Carroll.
That is exactly what Dominic Cummings and Boris Johnson are hoping for, that they will just get this election because that election is winnable. And that's what Dominic Cummings has been planning for this whole time. I think what he didn't plan for was the couple of missteps he took in the meantime, which has shown how chaotic and embalmed in crisis British society can become, is in right now. So I think that's the misstep. And if people are aware, Colin McCarthy is writing in this Sunday Independent today about people thinking that they want Brexit done and dusted, and that then it's they can just walk away like they're in a car lot and they've decided not to take the product that they've been haggling over. If people do become more aware, it's not just a referendum anymore. It's who you trust. And that's okay. Where voters will have a lot more to mull over come an election, if it's in the next few weeks or...
Okay, guys, will you put on your headphones there? Because we're joined now by Tim Lawton, who's Conservative MP for East Worthing and Shoreham. He's a former Children's Minister in David Cameron's government, and he is a keen Brexiteer. Tim, good morning. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Morning, Brendan.
Tim, can I ask you first, for you, what are the three worst things about being in the EU?
What are the three worst things about being in the EU?
Yeah.
Gosh, how can I shortlist down to three? I think it's the fact that the EU is the slowest growing bloc in the world. The share of the world's GDP taken by the EU has virtually halved over the last 20 years, and it's continuing to go the wrong way. And I want to be part of a trading world of the other 6.9 billion people. I think we are paying in too much money for getting very little back. And what we are getting back is restraint on the way we do our agriculture, the way we run regional policy and things like that. And thirdly, although I don't think this was the overriding issue in the referendum as many people thought, free movement of people has become completely impractical, and it was never in the founding purposes of the EU. It's free movement of labour.
What do you think is impractical about it?
Well, because when you have got economies within the EU moving at such different rates, so you've seen mass movements of people coming into some of the northern European countries, and particularly the UK from Eastern Europe, then I think that is a problem, which is why one of the main considerations in trying to get a reform of the EU, which I was very much part of before the referendum, because I wanted us to be able to get reform within the EU, not just for UK's sake, because I think the whole of the EU is unsustainable, had to be some break on free movement of people, and the EU just wouldn't give that. So if they weren't going to give it, but there was a serious prospect of the UK actually withdrawing from the EU, which then became the case, it was never going to happen. So those are just three, but there are many, many more. And there are many advantages of being in the EU as well. I'm not saying it's all black and white like that at all.
Yeah. Now, Tim, I don't know how it looks from your end, but watching from the outside, it's kind of... Yeah, so it looks as chaotic as it does to us, does it? Overnight, obviously, you lost Amber Rudd, or last night. Amber Rudd has cited many reasons for leaving. Among them is her discomfort at the withdrawal of the whip from the 21 so-called Tory rebels. She called it political vandalism. Were you comfortable with it?
No, I wasn't, and I spoke out about it both publicly and privately and challenged the Prime Minister on it. Those 21 colleagues, and many of them I've known for many, many years and are friends, were wrong. They did the wrong thing. I think at the very worst, they should have abstained rather than actively vote against the government. But this was a serious vote on a point of principle that would have taken powers away from the government, of which they are the same party. And on that basis, some action had to be taken. But I think losing 21 good colleagues at this time sends out the wrong signals. And so I've urged the Prime Minister to find a way that they can come back within the fold. And we really need the Conservative Party to be united if we're to push through this Brexit impasse.
The suggestion seems to be that they can be easily replaced with 21 other people who will toe the line on Brexit.
Well, that might be the case, but that doesn't make it right. And I'm against purges, and actually I raised with the Prime Minister, he and I both studied classical history. Purges in Roman times rarely ended well, and this just doesn't look good, and it's the impact it's had on other people as well, who weren't part of the 21, who feel uncomfortable about
it. And what did the Prime Minister say to you?
Well, I'm not going to say what he said to me, because it was in a closed meeting in the 1922 committee, but a number of other colleagues have raised it as well.
But can I ask you, did the Prime Minister offer a defence of it? Or there seems to have been a suggestion, the extreme suggestion would be that the Prime Minister at this stage is almost a puppet to Dominic Cummings, which I presume is not true. But is there any sense that you think the Prime Minister regrets doing that? That it would, even to the point of whatever about decency, the fact that it might have been a tactical error?
I think, one, he regrets it because many of them were friends and close colleagues of his. But secondly, I think it's a tactical error anyway, and I think there's the downside's more than the upside. So I think he would like to find a way to get former colleagues back in the tent, if at all possible.
But
he can't block Brexit, and we have just got to bring this whole thing to ahead and get beyond Brexit. I mean, it is deeply, deeply damaging.
Do you think that when you get beyond Brexit that will be the end of it? Is that that's the beginning of it, isn't it? This idea of let's get short of it and let's just move on. Is that not just the beginning of possibly a decade-long process of rebuilding trade agreements and everything else?
Well, there are two sides to that there. Of course, just coming out of the EU isn't the end of it. It is the beginning of all the subsequent detailed negotiations, and people sometimes forget, you know, the minute we come out of the EU, that's not all done and dusted, because that's when the detailed work of exactly the form of the trade agreement and of the status of residency and all that sort of thing gets nailed down. Although, frankly, a hell of a lot of work has been done on that, and it could turn out that that becomes the easier part of the whole exercise rather than actually getting out of the EU. The problem, Brendan, I think, with all of this is all the time we stay in the EU, there are people who think they can reverse that process so it won't happen. And many people, including in Parliament and including people whose constituencies voted to leave, are actively trying to undermine that process. And all the time...
Or are they just trying to undermine the idea of a no deal? Which, as I was saying earlier, a no deal was regarded as a really, really last resort, crazy option a couple of years ago, and it's now somehow become the norm.
Brendan, that's a complete fig leaf, and I made the point when I spoke this week. I'm afraid that people just need to be honest about this. For many, particularly within the Labour Party, and I'm not saying this applies to everybody, the hue and cry about a no-deal Brexit is a fig leaf for the fact they don't want Brexit to happen at all. All but seven Labour MPs, at the last time we voted on the withdrawal agreement, and it was similar to the previous two, voted against withdrawal agreement. They have voted against any way to make progress on Brexit at every single opportunity. They haven't put forward other forms of Brexit that would achieve realistically Brexit that Europe would accept. They have voted against everything. And
that's
the nub of the issue.
Okay, so, Tim, do you think Britain will leave the EU on October 31st?
Sorry, say again?
Will Britain leave the EU on October 31st?
I think it's 50-50. And it's very difficult to see how that can now be achieved because of the bill that went through last week, which I certainly voted against, and I think undermines the whole parliamentary
process. But Boris Johnson says he will do it. He would rather die in a ditch. It's happening.
And I'm sure he would. Now, I don't know what other mechanisms, all sorts of new parliamentary schemes come out of nowhere and have been used in the last few weeks and months. So I don't know what's going to happen between now and the end of October. What I hope happens, and I think is still a strong possibility, and if the EU has got any sense, they want to get this over and done with as well. They want to have a relationship with us that's sustainable and not completely based on acrimony after October the 31st or whenever, that when Boris goes to the Brussels summit in the middle of October, there can be some offer on the agreement around the backstop and others.
What kind of an offer?
Well, they're talking at the moment about having a properly time-limited backstop, but what I'd also like...
Who's talking about that?
there have been some serious proposals.
Can I ask you, who's talking about having a properly time-limited backstop?
A number of people around Parliament and certain politicians, particularly in Germany as well. This whole thing is completely confected. And the alternative arrangements for the British border from the Prosperity Commission has come up with a lot of practical solutions. It is entirely political.
But then we're told Amber Rudd says...
being solved.
Sorry to interrupt you, Tim. Amber Rudd says there isn't... She's in Cabinet. She sees no evidence that Boris Johnson is looking for a deal. She says there are like one-pagers going around the place about stuff.
Well, she's just wrong.
She's wrong.
She's one person in Cabinet. That is her view.
But sure, it's what we're hearing from Europe all the time, Tim. They say Boris Johnson is telling his domestic base that we are having very productive discussions in Europe, and plenty of people in Europe are turning around and going, we don't know what this guy is talking about. There are no discussions happening.
Everybody knows what needs to be done. And at this next summit, proposals need to be put forward. And if Boris was able to come back by the EU leaders, where there is some flexibility on the agreements we've already had. And I think if that were then put before Parliament this time, it will get through. And the reason it will get through this time is because there has been a shift of heart by a lot of Labour MPs who now realise that this is deeply damaging and would lose them their seats to Brexit Party candidates in their own constituencies, in the North of England in particular.
So
and
are you suggesting that if Boris Johnson could come back with enough of a kind of an altered version of Theresa May's deal, that this time people would just, including all the Conservatives who voted against it, would actually support it this time just to get it through?
There will be enough people voting for it, both within the Conservative Party and, crucially, Labour MPs, that we could get it through. And therefore, October the 31st becomes possible again, because that legislation, as we've seen, can get through Parliament very quickly. We got this bill through in a couple of days last week. It can be done if there is the political will to do it. And if Europe really wants to have an agreement and really wants to have a good, constructive relationship beyond October the 31st, frankly, Angela Merkel and Emmanuel Macron can say, let's get this done. It's entirely within their remit.
Tim, I'm going to bring in the panel in a minute, and I'd like you to stay with us. Can I ask you one question that I think is intriguing everybody at the moment? Is Dominic Cummings out of control, in your opinion?
Well, I don't know. I worked alongside Dominic Cummings for some years when I was on the education team with Michael
Gove. How did you find him?
He was Michael Gove's special advisor. He's a very, very difficult person to get on with. He is brilliant in many respects. But I also find he can be deeply damaging and has little regard to the damage that he can cause.
And do you think he's doing damage to your government and your Prime Minister right now?
I think the way things have been handled have not been good in some cases. And I think strategically some mistakes have been made.
Has he become a lightning rod for kind of poison within the party now? Is it time for him to go?
Well, a lot of people are unhappy with his approach, put it that way. So I think he would be under a lot of pressure, and a lot of colleagues would prefer to come to the Prime Minister from other sources, let me put it diplomatically like that.
OK. Tim, will you stay with us? And I want to bring in the panel to talk to you. Kevin Doyle.
Well, just, Brendan, break down a few things that Tim has said there, because the UK media, the Tory party has been cheered on largely by the UK media. So a lot of what Tim has said there has gone unchallenged for weeks and months, really, in the UK media. And the idea that the proposal should be brought at the EU summit by Angela Merkel and Emmanuel Macron on the 17th of October is ridiculous. That's not how it works. You go to those summit for these things to be signed off on. This is why you have David Frost and Michel Barnier and all these people, allegedly, according to the UK, negotiating. But according to the EU and our own government here, there's very little, if nothing, happening there. So this idea that Boris Johnson rocks up on the 17th of October and suddenly Europe has a 500-page document that resolves everything, details the alternative arrangements, and everybody goes home happy is just ridiculous. It can't happen at that last minute.
Tim, do you accept that's ridiculous?
I'm not saying that it's all going to happen on the day at the summit. I'm saying is, in the next 6-7 weeks before that summit, the ground needs to be laid, and it partly has, but a lot more to be done, so that on points of principle they can agree on, and then they can talk about the detail at the summit itself. This is entirely political. All these questions are political questions, and it just needs political goodwill.
OK, Tim, I'm going to bring in John Bruton now, who's a former Taoiseach.
I think the problem is that what agreement could you envisage that could get through the House of Commons? I think it's clear that it is the British side in this negotiation that's in a better position to say what would get through the House of Commons than anyone in Paris or Berlin. So if there was a serious endeavour on the part of Britain to reach an agreement, one would have expected that by now Boris Johnson and David Frost would have tabled pretty detailed proposals as to how they would reconcile the Belfast Agreement, the Good Friday Agreement, with Brexit. They have not done that. They have simply, as Tim is doing now, looking to somebody else to solve a problem of their own creation. And as Kevin has pointed out, that's not the way the EU works. The EU, at summits, deals with something that's already been pre-cooked. Well, it looks as if the menu hasn't even been chosen yet, let alone anything being put into the oven.
Tim.
Well, I don't want to introduce too many mixed metaphors to the whole thing, but a serious part of the original agreement, which people took umbrage with, was the whole business about the backstop. Now, a number of proposals were put forward under the Malthouse amendment, and a lot of work has been done by the Prosperity Commission group, and their report came out recently, where they put forward practical proposals for how we can address the concerns around the backstop. Now, the problem was Theresa May never took those back to the EU. And I think we could have had these discussions around those practicalities some time ago. And I want those discussions to be happening now. They've been happening between parliamentarians. I know my colleagues, Nicky Morgan, who's now back in the Cabinet, and Greg Hands, have been taking those proposals around various European parliamentarians, particularly in Germany, and meeting a large degree of positivity. Now, that needs to be the basis of how we get through
this. But you see, Tim, it's not the basis of how it's done, because the basis of it is that you are negotiating between the UK and the European Commission. And the way it looks at the moment, unless everybody in Europe is lying, is that the UK has not brought anything practical to the Commission.
But there are a whole load of practical things that I've just pointed to that are on the table here, and they need to be put before the Commission openly, if you're saying they're not at all. These things can be solved. And you say that it's not the way, I keep hearing this phrase, it's not the way the EU do things. Well, the EU has never been faced with the prospect of one of its major members leaving the EU in completely. We are in completely uncharted territory, and more pragmatism has got to come into this whole argument.
Yeah, I think I actually saw somewhere, Tim, that nobody in the history of the modern world has left a trading bloc ever. So we are in very uncharted territory. I'm going to bring in Suzanne Lynch, Tim.
Yeah. Hi, Tim. Just this week here, I was speaking to someone, a senior person in Brussels, a contact of mine, and they were making the point that the biggest fear now is that even if something was agreed on alternative arrangements for the backstop, which is obviously a huge if, that the concern really in Brussels and in capitals is that there are a lot more issues that Britain is going to start reneging on. For example, the divorce bill. That's a whole battle that may emerge. Secondly, a really worrying development from the EU side this week was the fact that British negotiators in Brussels seem to be saying that they now want more regulatory divergence than was ever indicated by Theresa May. So the ground is shifting completely, so that even if there was something agreed on the backstop, some kind of compromise, well, is that going to be enough? And it's back to John's question. You know, what will be enough to get this through Parliament? What about the divorce bill, for example? Is there going to be another battle over that before the October the 31st? So I think that's one of the worries in Brussels, that if you give a bit of ground here, there's actually an ocean of further changes that are now demanded by Britain as it moves further towards, you know, a no-deal scenario.
Yeah, Tim, the backstop won't do it on its own, will it?
Well, you can't have it both ways. One minute you're saying there are no discussions, no proposals happening with Europe at all at the moment, and now you're telling me that there are new proposals that would row back on the divorce bill and on regulation and things like that.
Yeah, and I think what Suzanne is saying, in fairness, Tim, is that you are reneging on things that we thought were already agreed. So that it's rather than going forward with new proposals, you're going backwards.
One minute we're not talking, the next minute we're reneging. You can't have it both ways. The flagship issue here, the political big problem for us, and it's a problem for the DUP, obviously, and we would need, ideally, to get the DUP on side for this, is to have a flexible approach to the backstop that we can get through. Now, that is the big issue, and frankly, when I voted for the agreement twice anyway, frankly, it would not take a lot else to tweak this agreement to get it through. And as I say, there's a group of now at least 50 Labour MPs who have formed a group, and as much as said, well, if the agreement, the original agreement, were to come back, actually this time, they would vote for it. Now, I don't believe we're reneging on £39 billion. I think it's become, in fact, it's less than £39 billion now because of the extended time we've been part of the EU after March. And I think if there's serious goodwill to get this agreement through, because everybody is completely ground down over the whole thing, then we will pay our dues. I really don't think that is a problem. But expecting us to pay £39 billion on a no deal and complete chaos, well, that was never going to be a serious prospect. So I don't think it will take much, frankly, to get a tweaked version of an original deal through. And as I say, I think, ironically, the subsequent negotiations around the terms of trade, et cetera, once we're out, once there's no going back and everybody appreciates, acknowledges that, I think could turn out to be simpler than the actual getting out process has turned out to be.
OK, Tim, I'm going to bring in Jim Power, economist.
Yeah, I mean, just take up the point about the £39 billion. I mean, the £39 billion was a bill that the UK was legally obliged to pay back to the EU.
It was, regardless
of what type of exit happened on March 29th last or on October 31st next, Britain has that legal liability. Because
I disagree.
Well, you can disagree, but you're wrong. Based on the amount of money that the EU has given Britain for various schemes, there is a £39 billion bill, okay? From a European perspective, you know, I think there are conflicting forces here. As I see it, you know, Germany, the economy is on the brink of recession. The UK is a very important trading partner of Germany's, and a UK hard Brexit without a trade deal with Germany would be very bad news for the German economy. So there is that conflicting force. But on the other side, I think there's a huge matter of principle here. If the EU is seen to roll back on the negotiating position it has adopted to date, I think it creates a very dangerous longer-term precedent for the European Union in terms of future countries perhaps wanting to leave down the road. I also believe firmly, observing what's going on at the moment, that the Boris Johnson government does not want a deal on October 17th at the summit. I think he will come back from that summit without a deal, and at that stage he will be legally obliged, based on the bill that was passed last week, to apply for an extension. He will refuse to do that. Then you will have a Supreme Court decision deciding where it goes from there. And at that stage, Boris Johnson, you know, it's this plan B that Dominic Cummins is alleged to be driving. At that stage, Boris Johnson would resign and invite Jeremy Corbyn or some sort of cross-party alliance to form a government. And thereafter, Johnson will then have an opportunity for an election. And based on the opinion polls at the moment, a 14-point lead over the Labour Party, it's an election they could very easily win.
Is that the plan, Tim, do you think?
Well, Jim has got the most enormous crystal ball. frankly.
Okay, Tim, can I, and this is the, it is a million dollar question, and perhaps it's the $39 billion
question. It's not a crystal ball, it's a theory.
Tim, can I ask you, where, how do you see, and I know this is impossible, but give it your best shot, how do you see it panning out from here? How do you see it panning out over the next couple of weeks?
I genuinely don't know. I mean, that's because things have been changing so quickly. And when we went back to Parliament last Tuesday after summer recess, we weren't expecting all the events that happened last week. And there's a lot of what Jim has just said. I absolutely take issue with two things. And we may have legal responsibilities on part of that £39 billion. We do not have legal responsibilities on the whole lot. That's a matter for lawyers to argue. I'm not a lawyer. And the second thing, I absolutely fundamentally disagree that it is Boris's intention deliberately not to get a deal. We have got to bring this thing to a resolution. And the easiest way and the cleanest way for all of us for it to be brought to a resolution is to have flexibility towards tweaking the deal that can be agreed at the summit so that we can smoothly come out on the 31st of October. And then everything else that Jim said doesn't apply. But we are in a real catch-22 situation here, not least because of the Fixed Term Parliaments Act. In normal circumstances, when a government cannot get its legislation through and on such a crucial matter as Brexit, and effectively delivering on manifesto promises, which we did there, then the government would resign and we would put it to the people in a general election. Because of the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, where it was never envisaged that an opposition that virtually daily has been saying we need to get rid of this government, we need a general election now, would then say, well, actually we don't, we're going to vote against it. So he's completely constrained on not being able to go to the country for an election. And that's the only way of resolving this, although frankly, the fractious nature of the country at the moment, you could come up with a hung parliament after a general election and we're back where we started. So it's not a guarantee, but I think people want to see this resolved and will go with a party where you can actually see a way out of all of this. And at the moment, it's only the Conservative Party that's got that, because we've got the ridiculous suggestion we've had from the Labour Party this week, where they say if they had a Labour government under Jeremy Corbyn, they would negotiate with Europe for a better deal. Okay, if they think they can get one. But at the same time, they would support a second referendum, and in that referendum, they would be supporting the Remain side. So they want to negotiate a deal with Europe, which they then are going to say they're going to vote against because they want Remain. It's complete and utter nonsense.
John Bruton.
The fundamental problem is that it goes back to Theresa May drawing the red lines, which excluded participation in the single market and excluded participation in the customs union. Britain could have fulfilled the mandate of the referendum and left the EU, but stayed in the customs union and stayed in the single market. But before even starting the negotiation, those options were ruled out. So Britain has narrowed and narrowed its own options. So any initiative, any initiative to resolve this has to come from Britain. And it has to come from Britain's government.
Just one second, I'll let you back in. Tim, give us a brief last word, please.
No, for me, remaining in the single market and the customs union doesn't fulfil Brexit, but in the manifesto where Theresa May went to the country in 2017, it explicitly said we would no longer remain part of the customs union or the single market. So those were red lines on which the people voted in 2017.
And she got no majority on that basis.
Well, she didn't get a majority and she lost seats, but actually she got the largest Conservative share of the vote and number of votes since, I think, 1992. But we very clearly stood on a manifesto that Brexit could not be achieved by staying part of the customs union and single...
Yeah, and
single
you market. Also very clearly stood on a manifesto of it not being a no-deal Brexit. You stood on a manifesto of an orderly Brexit with a great relationship afterwards.
This is a complete fallacy. I mean, people keep saying nowhere on the ballot paper in the referendum did it say no deal.
No, your manifesto in the last general election.
Nowhere on...
Sure, the ballot paper on the referendum didn't define what Brexit was at all. And is this not why we're in the mess we're in?
Well, if we'd had to have a referendum with an even more complicated series of questions, which is another reason why having a second referendum now would be completely impractical, what actually is the question? But we did not say in our manifesto in 2017, we would not come out with a no-deal Brexit. Never has that been an undertaking. I don't want it. It's not a preference.
I think you said you would come out with an orderly Brexit, but okay. Listen, Tim, thank you very much for joining us this morning. Really appreciate it. Tim Lawton, and we'll take a break.
podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Tesco Club Card, helping you save more every time you shop. Tesco, every little helps.
Welcome back. Our panel are still with us. John Bruton, Sinead O'Carroll, Kevin Doyle, Suzanne Lynch and Jim Power. Let's take a little step back and a breather now for a minute. And let's a moment of relative lightness in the Sunday Business Post. Kevin, you were looking at Nadine O'Regan has done a podcast with Pascal Donoghue, and she has a piece about her interview there. Tell us about it.
He gave the answer that no politician is ever supposed to give, which is when asked if you would like to be Taoiseach at some point in the future, he's actually said no, which is fascinating in its own way, although I would never accuse him of lying, but I would question
because
that.
I always thought that there was a sense a few years ago that Pascal Donoghue didn't want to be Taoiseach, but in the last year or two, was there not more of a sense that Pascal Donoghue would like to be Taoiseach? Was that
Within Fine Gael, he's certainly seen as the coming man. There's questions about whether Simon Coveney would want another go at it, or whether he might look to the private sector or to something in Europe, given how the leadership bid went for him last time. So Pascal Donoghue and Simon Harris are the two names that were being put out there. Now, Simon Harris quite recently did an interview with Politico, which is one of these European websites, very well respected, where he said, of course, he would never rule it out. And the headline ended up being the next Irish PM, Simon Harris, the youngest member of cabinet who could go on to do it. And of course, that raised a lot of eyebrows. So I suspect that, Pascal Donoghue maybe won't be chopping the knees off Leo Varadkar to get into that seat, particularly at the moment. I suspect it's calculated by virtue of the fact that if he's asked that question, and at this moment in time, if he said, of course, I'd love to be Taoiseach, we'd have a field day in the gallery on Leinster House in what we'd write about that at this particular moment.
So the headline is, I'm a writer, not a ruler. He'd prefer to be writing a book.
He's a complete bookworm, and I don't know where he gets the time between writing budgets and summer economic statements and Brexit and Ecofin meetings and all the rest of it, but he's constantly reading books and he's written a lot of book reviews, and I have one at home on my shelf because one day he recommended some book which I subsequently bought off Amazon, and I think I got through two pages and went, holy God. Okay. There's no way you'd read it.
So in the political world we live in today, this man is suspect. He's not only reading books, but he's reading difficult books. He wouldn't last long now in some countries.
But there could be choppier waters ahead for Pascal Donoghue. I mean, a lot of discussion over the last few months has been, who's had a good Brexit in a sense, Leo Varadkar versus Simon Coveney. Pascal Donoghue has managed to keep out of the fray somewhat, but the budget coming up next month, if there is a no deal or indeed, bigger economic headwinds out there, and he is forced to take more difficult choices, well then I think there could be a lot more media attention critically on him and the choices he's making and the stewardship of the economy. So it's a kind of a summer news article, I think, about his interest in literature, etc. But I think that's going to change very rapidly as the timetable of the next term develops.
Yeah, John, it's very early to say who's had a good Brexit in political terms, isn't it? Like the Chinese guy in the French Revolution. Too early to say.
There's been no Brexit, hasn't happened anyway, so yeah. We don't know. No, I agree. I think Kevin's absolutely right. Pascal Donoghue was being very prudent in his answer to that question.
And I think he has also given himself a little bit of wriggle room, because later on he talks about what politics is like right now, and obviously we all kind of think of him as a very serious person, and that bookworm thing goes to that. And he said, at the moment professional politics has let its craft down. Politics is a deadly serious craft, and when you confuse it with celebrity, when you confuse it with trivia, it has consequences that matter. There's a need for reflection, there's a need for words not spoken in haste. So you can imagine in a few years time, if he stands up and says, in the national interest, and I am being called, I know I said before,
exit my library and walk down among the common people.
I had a similar experience to Kevin with a book that he recommended, except that I bought from my local bookshop, not on Amazon, okay?
Sorry.
Good man.
I think Pascal Donoghue faces certainly on October 8th this year, the most difficult budget that any finance minister has faced here. Because back in Brian Lenihan's day, when he introduced those very difficult budgets, there was no choice. We're in a situation of deep crisis. This time, he's setting a budget against a background. On the one hand, the economy is doing well. And Dan O'Brien highlights that very clearly in the Sunday Independent today. Good piece there. But on the other side, we have this Brexit mallet about to come down on the economy. So setting a budget in that environment is going to be incredibly difficult. So I think in the next 3 or 4 months, Pascal Donoghue is really going to create his legacy. And I think that then will set him up for what comes further down the road.
It is worth noting in talking about all the seriousness and saying he's a very serious politician and all the rest of it in the picture that's in the Business Post. In the background on the window shelf in his office, you can quite clearly see all his Star Wars figurines, including Darth Vader.
See that?
All lined up there.
Okay. Jim, you mentioned Amazon versus buying in the local shop there. And
I was only having a go at Kevin there, sorry.
You were looking at a piece, was it in the
Sunday Times?
In the Sunday Times.
I wasn't indeed, yeah.
Because I think that a lot of people are starting to think about what will Brexit mean for me in my life, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things they're thinking about is, will I still be able to buy 10 dresses off ASOS and send 9 of them back for free the next day? And will it be as frictionless as it was?
Yeah. Last week, the Competition and Consumer Protection Commission here in Ireland issued a warning that in the event of a no-deal Brexit, that Irish consumers who buy online from the UK could no longer be guaranteed the sort of rights they currently have when buying from another EU country. So in other words, you have the right to return within 14 days, lots of other consumer rights built into EU law. So there is a theory out there in the Irish retail sector that in the run-up to Christmas this year, that actually no-deal Brexit could be good for consumer spending because people will worry about buying online from the UK because they might lose all their rights. And then there are issues around delivery times, etc. Okay. But John Lewis, UK retailer, and Littlewoods, and another retailer, fashion retailer I'd never heard of, but that says more about me than anything else.
I can see that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Thank you, Brendan. But they have come out and basically stated that they will guarantee Irish purchasers of their product online the same rights as they currently have under UK and EU legislation.
Except that I've noticed before that, am I not right in saying that if you do buy something from outside of the EU, you pay the customs and duties on it and you return it, you don't always seem to get the customs and duties back. It seems to be a bit of a grey area.
There is a bit of a grey area there, yeah. One interesting experience I had during the week, and I suppose this flies in the face of what I was just saying, but there is, I do a lot of walking, and there's a brand of shoes I use, and there's only one place I can get them in Ireland. The last time I went looking for them, they didn't have them in stock. So I went online and bought them from the UK about 6 months ago. So I went back on the UK website the week before last to buy another pair, and the Ireland option is gone off their website. So they can now only be delivered into the UK.
Which you'd imagine that's going
to
happen.
That's probably their level of
it is indeed
Brexit proofing. I think with a lot of these, the headlines that people are making after a no-deal Brexit, this is what might happen. The big one that stuck out for me this week was Northern Irish cars might have to have GB stickers on them even if they're travelling in Ireland. And we looked into it just to see how complex it could get. And Dominic McGrath, my colleague, looked, and we were reading 1949 conventions from Geneva and 1968 conventions from Vienna to try and get some kind of answer. There was two different British government websites that gave two different answers to would you need a GB sticker, and you kind of do if you're reading the 1949 convention, 1968 convention, and we don't want to flout international road traffic laws, but who's going to enforce them? Nobody knows. The Gardaí were like, I think that's a Department of Transport issue. The Department of Transport obviously weren't going to tell us anything. So all of this, as John was saying earlier, Brexit, we don't know what it is and we don't know when it's actually going to happen. And any of these answers are just so unclear.
OK, listen, we just have a couple of minutes and I want to draw your attention to a piece that was in the Journal, Sinead, on Friday. The Zimbabwe leader was viewed as a pariah by the West for decades. Things were different in 1983. This is about Mugabe coming to Ireland in 1983. Tell us about that visit.
Yeah, so when his death was announced during the week, I was not alive in 1983, but my knowledge from this time came from the state papers when the 30-year documents get released. So into 2013 when we were down looking at them, there was a lot of documents in the Taoiseach's papers about what they would do about Robert Mugabe visiting.
And the dinner plans, I thought, were particularly fascinating.
The dinner plans were particularly fascinating because there was a lot of things that were off the menu, and there was very specific requests from Mugabe and his wife Sally about things that they didn't like. They really didn't like Ribena for some reason. Was literally written on the list of things that were banned, but fruit juice was okay, and there was lines about cornflakes and things like that. Also, Gareth Fitzgerald was very taken with the idea that he should pick the wine, but he dithered a bit and delayed a bit so that
Gareth Fitzgerald never dithered and delayed.
He overthought it a little bit to the ire of his people who needed to get this menu printed and done up. But there was actually more serious concerns as well at the time. A number of Zimbabwe Air Force officers had been detained, white officers had been detained over the sabotage of 13 planes. There had been concerns that their torture methods had been used against them. The British embassy had been on to the Irish government and had used a little bit of media power to talk to Ireland to try and get them to bring this up with Mugabe. Gareth Fitzgerald and his aides didn't want to have any kind of diplomatic incident and were trying to be very careful. So the whole thing, even though he wasn't seen as pariah, so
the inklings were starting.
The inklings were there,
stage.
And there was
John
a lot
Duncan,
of worries.
Do you remember it?
I do. I was minister in the government at the time, and I was at the dinner. I don't remember.
Oh, was the wine?
I don't remember. I don't remember. But Gareth would have known his wine. I think he was, as you know, he was francophone and he spoke Spanish, so he would have travelled a lot and would have known something about wine. I think there was a beginning of a suspicion of Mugabe at that time already. Initially, and I remember this, I don't know whether it was when we were in opposition or in government, that Gareth as leader was quite favourable to Mugabe in the beginning and not so favourable to Bishop Muzorewa and the other, I've forgotten his name now, the other leader that potentially might have been alternatives to Joshua Nkomo, who could have been alternatives to Mugabe. But I think as time went on, people began to realise that they supported the wrong man, certainly if they wanted this potentially very prosperous country, Zimbabwe, to do well.
Yeah, OK, so just getting awkward at that point of that dinner, we would say. All right, thanks, John Bruton, and let's take a break. Thanks, Susan. Our panel's still with us. John Bruton, Sinead O'Carroll, Kevin Doyle, Suzanne Lynch and Jim Power. Sinead O'Carroll, as a retired now Camogie player, the final today won't be the same without Cork in it, sure it won't.
God, why would you say that? It's actually something that we relish, the rest of the country, that it is a final without Cork. I think it's the first one in a long time. I'm a bit more excited about this one this year and I have higher hopes for it. The last two finals have been pretty dismal affairs, unfortunately, for a number of reasons. The way the teams were setting up using kind of defensive sweeper systems and also just the refereeing to the absolute rule. And I think most people who have any knowledge of Camogie now and have heard the news of the last year, most Camogie players are really, really, really begging for new rules that are more in line with how we play it for the rest of the year. Camogie and hurling rules differ quite a lot, particularly around contact. And if it is refereed to the rule of the game, a lot of the time it becomes a free-taking competition, which it did last year. To no blame on the referee at all. He did it to the rules, but it just becomes less of the game we want to play and less of the game people want to watch. This year there's been a little bit more leniency with refs. Ray Kelly is actually a Kildare man and someone I've had a lot of dealings with over the years. But
all good, I can tell.
All good. Hi Ray, if you're listening. He obviously isn't, he's preparing, but he is will let the game flow, I think, a little bit more today. And there's just a lot more openness, both with the Galway team. If anyone watched the semi-finals, Galway were relentless against Cork and really deserved that semi-final win. Kilkenny have taken Anne Dalton out of that sweeper system, which we've all really wanted. She's been playing in the forwards, has been playing fantastically. There are really, really great forwards on both sides. So a nice open match today, I think, will really help. Hopefully we will have 25,000 people there. The Camogie Association have asked for that. It's on RT. The three matches are on RT, so we really need a spectacle. We're catching up on the ladies football, trying to, you know, provide people with a game that they really want to watch. And the girls are fantastic. The hurling is there. It's just kind of making sure that A, people are seeing it, and B, they're given the opportunity to play to the best of their abilities.
And call it for us.
I actually I've got the last three right and a couple of them have gone against the grain, and I'm really slow to call this one, so I'm actually going to say that it might be a draw.
Okay, and the junior final, Kerry in Limerick, started at 12. The intermediate final, Galway and Westmeath, is on at 2. And the senior final, Galway and Kilkenny, is on at 4:15. And as Sinead said, you can follow it on RTE.ie, on the RTE News Now app from 1 p.m. And there'll be live commentary on the senior final on Sunday Sport on RTE Radio 1 with Pádraig Lodge.
Or if you're anywhere in Leinster, you'll be able to get there.
Okay.
4:15. You'd have loads of time to get in the car and get up.
Okay, and it'd be a good match.
Absolutely
good
worth it. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, a story that would probably be much bigger if we weren't all obsessing about Brexit, but it is the other story that's tipping away. There is the beef wars, I guess, the beef battle. Jim Power, you're kind of involved in this to some extent, aren't you?
Yeah, I've been working for 6 months on an in-depth study of the beef sector for the IFA, due to be completed a few days ago, but because of reasons of what's going on at the moment, I haven't finished it yet because there's just new information presenting itself every day.
What are you looking for?
I'm just trying to understand, what exactly is happening in the beef sector. And if you look at the supply chain, and there's a headline in one of the papers today, you alluded earlier, that Beef Plan is planning to protest outside some of the retail distribution units this week. Yeah. Okay. And in looking at the whole beef sector, I mean, beef production, full stop, is being hit with a perfect storm at the moment. Not just in Ireland, it's all over Europe. It's a kind of a global thing rather than just specifically Irish. But there are massive headwinds at the moment on the beef sector. You have the whole issue around climate change and the environment and the impact that beef production has on that. You have the change in consumer tastes away from beef. You also have massive competition on the protein sector from chicken and pork. Okay, so, and then you have the Mercosur trade deal, which is causing a lot of problems.
Okay,
you
but
have
are some people still making money out of beef?
Who's
making the money?
As I see it, you could really break it down into thirds. The top third are very efficient and are making money. They're up there with dairy farmers in terms of profitability, or close enough. You have a middle tier that's doing it reasonably well, but is still very exposed to the vagaries of all of those market forces that I've just tried to describe. And then you have the bottom third.
And does this go by size of farms?
And geography.
Yeah,
I mean,
okay.
You have the bottom third that are just not that efficient, perhaps because the land they're rearing beef on is just not that good. So in the Western, I'm not writing off beef production in the Western seaboard, but a lot of beef production in the West, which is an incredibly important part of rural economies, but
yeah,
it's pretty subsistence stuff. So, but yet it makes a very strong social and economic contribution to the west of Ireland, particularly where dairy farming wouldn't be that strong.
I haven't had lamb chops in ages, right? And a neighbour gave me some potatoes, and I thought I fancy a few lamb chops with them. I was stunned. 10 lamb chops, not gigantic ones, but 10 good sized lamb chops, not the little ones. How much do you think I paid in the supermarket that'll remain nameless for a big pack of 10 of them? A tenner.
I was going to say €8.
The
reality is that, I've analysed over the last 10 years, the average price of beef in the retail grocery sector has fallen by 3.4%. Okay? And at the same time, the average price of chicken and pork have fallen significantly further. So there's the sort of competition for beef.
But is all this cheap food ultimately is kind of unsustainable, not in the climate, economically,
retailers, and the retailers are not around the table at the negotiations, and there is no plan to bring them in, and that's why Beef Plan is going to protest outside the
retail. Doesn't make more sense that they protest there rather than the beef factories, because when they were breaking down the price of beef, it is the retailers who seem to be getting the most.
Nobody agrees on the breakdown, do they?
The figures that were thrown out, you could certainly argue with. The figures that Beef Plan came out with was that for every €10 that was spent, the farmer basically got 20%.
Mm.
Okay. And, their argument was that the retailer got €5.10 for 3 days' work,
yeah,
the processor got €2.90 for 3 days' work, and then the farmer got €2 out of the 10 for 2 or 3 years, depending on how long they're here.
And according to your research, are those figures accurate?
They're not accurate, actually. I was looking, the retail price for beef is €8.97 per kg, okay? The equivalent farm gate price is €3.90. However, the price paid to the farmer is a carcass, including the bone, whereas what the retailer is selling doesn't include the bone. So you have to adjust for what the farmer gets and what the retailer is selling. But I would estimate on that basis that the farmer is getting somewhere between 40 and 50% of the retail price. That figure will get me hung. A lot of people will disagree with it, but based on my analysis, which isn't complete yet, but that's the direction I'm heading in at the moment. Yeah. The problem in the beef sector, the supply chain, you know, at the top of the supply chain, you have the retailer. In the middle, you have the processor, and then you have the farmer producing. I was going to say at the bottom of the chain, but they take that as an insult. Yeah. But they're the ones that produce the primary product. And the cap on what the whole supply chain delivers is at the retail level. Yeah. And retailers are obviously dealing with a consumer that wants, that wants cheap food. And that puts an immediate cap on the price that the processor
in a sense, we have to start thinking of meat as a luxury thing. And I think a lot of people
I think a cheap food policy is fundamentally wrong. It delivered BSE in the UK back in the 80s. If consumers want quality food, they should be prepared to pay for it. If they don't,
John Bruton, am I right? You come from a beef farming background.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Many of my relatives are beef producers. I think the problem here is that you have economic concentration at the level of the beef processor. You have economic concentration at the level of the retailers, big retail chains, and farmers are numerous, dispersed, and in competition with one another. So the margin tends to go to where the power is concentrated rather than where it's dispersed. And, you know, some of the proposals, for example, that they would get a better price for 30-month-old beef, well, it costs a lot more to produce 30-month-old beef than to produce a mature animal at 2 or 3 years because the extra cost of overwintering the animal.
And just for people who don't know, the 30 months, you get more 30, money for 30 month beef because that is a
proposal that's been made.
Cut-off point. Well, I think it is.
That was based on BSE because
most of the supermarkets demand, isn't it, is 30
Except the German retailers are branching out a little bit from that. I think it's Aldi have said they'll take them up to 36 months now, which kind of opens up the window at which point the farmer can bring it to the factory and then move it. But to Sinead's point on the idea that they're moving it now to target the retailers, I think that's because this story, even though it's been running for weeks, if not months really, has just gone largely under the radar because there's still beef in all the shops. So therefore, the public don't really care. And I think the next step here is the day that there might be no beef in the shop because we've had such stock of supplies that even though the factories haven't been killing, the supplies are still coming.
Is there really going to be a revolution overnight because there's no beef in the shops? You just get chicken instead.
Actually, Brendan, Kevin, I beg your pardon. The sort of pressure point here or the release valve here is that, you know, if Irish beef isn't being produced and sold in Irish retailers, it'll be brought in from overseas. Yeah.
For cheaper.
For cheaper. Well, perhaps.
Suzanne, give you a brief last word.
Story again, it's just so high that the exports are so, take up so much of the proportion of the production of beef here. And even 92%. In America, it's very slow. Ireland, for various different reasons, but it's competing against, you know, American beef, but also other kinds of beef, and it's marketing itself as a grass-fed product, but it's on very few shelves, really, when it comes to it in the United States. It hasn't really increased its presence there. Yeah. Because that really does have to be looked at, particularly in the context of Brexit.
We need to find a way of marketing beef and product differentiating the beef on the basis, A, that it's grass-fed, and then by particular cattle breeds. Look at the way they're able to sell wine by saying what farm it came from.
If you go to a restaurant, in a lot of restaurants, they will now tell you what kind of beef you're getting and in Dexter and this and that, and the price issue is not as big
a deal in the US where, you know, Whole Foods or these big supermarkets where everything is quite expensive and those kind of consumers there are prepared to pay the extra for New Zealand lamb or whatever.
Jim, I want to move on if you don't mind, because Eamon Malley is waiting very patiently on the phone from Belfast. Good afternoon, Eamon.
Good afternoon, Brendan.
So, Eamon, next Tuesday, the BBC Northern Ireland is broadcasting Spotlight on the Troubles of Secret History. And, of course, we've seen in the papers and on the news revelations made in the programme about Martin McGuinness and Ian Paisley. You've seen, it's seven part series, you've seen all of it, have you? What are your impressions of it?
No, I have seen the first programme, which is a 90-minute programme, which is the context of the overall programme. It's sort of a backdrop to the overall programmes. And the one theme in this particular programme would be Ian Paisley and Martin McGuinness, two men who dedicated so much of their lives to topple Stormont and who eventually ended up running Northern Ireland in that very building, Stormont, Parliament Buildings. So that's one theme. But the controversy arises out of an allegation against Ian Paisley made by a former army officer, who alleged that a district inspector in Kilkeel informed him, told him that, he went further than he told him anyhow, that Ian Paisley provided the money for a bombing in South Down in 1969. Now, the Paisley family are absolutely outraged. They are fulminating over this allegation, and Peter Robertson has come out and categorically rejected this, although there was a big split between the Robertsons and the Paisleys later in life. But Peter Robertson has come out and totally dismissed this allegation. Now, on the screen, we see an officer in civvies making the allegation that he was told by this inspector, police inspector. We don't see any writing, any article or a document in writing. I certainly don't know the police officer in question. I don't know if anyone, whether the police officer is dead or alive, or if anybody attempted to find the police officer. And therefore, there's such controversy now. Mrs. Paisley is fulminating over this. She's totally dismissing it. And furthermore, I researched this period myself because I spent a long time interviewing Mr. Paisley in 2-hour-long documentaries for the BBC. And I questioned him about that whole period. And he was in jail at the specific time which arises. So there is so much controversy over this. Now, the second controversial area is the on-screen images of Martin McGuinness in a car with a gun in his hand, with all the kids around the car. And then there is bomb being prepared, and 30 minutes later, in a van vehicle, and 30 minutes later, a bomb explodes in Ship's Quay Street. Or unless I'm totally delusional, the figure behind the would-be bomb vehicle is Martin McGuinness.
He was identified as well, wasn't he, by a contemporary of his who looked at the footage and said, that's Martin.
Shane Paul O'Doherty is identifying him, but unless I'm delusional after all these years, the figure is Martin McGuinness and the man in the car is Martin McGuinness. Now, Republicans are not taking issue with this at all. In fact, the MP for the area, Ailish McCallion, she speaks and it pays tribute to Martin McGuinness's contribution to what she calls the fight and to politics and fighting for everybody.
So, and of course, Martin McGuinness has never denied being in the IRA. And so would it fall into the period in which Martin McGuinness admits he was in the IRA?
1972. And he didn't deny. He went into the Savile Inquiry in camera. He told the inquiry he was number two in the city at the time of Bloody Sunday. But so the visuals, and that is testament. The archival material is there. It's shown. It's been procured from outside the country, that particular recording, that filming. It has never been seen on this island before. But it's the controversy around the allegation against Mr. Paisley, which is really sort of dominating.
Just before we leave Martin McGuinness, Eamon, I think some people, it was shown on the news here the other night, I think some people were a bit taken aback, though, whether he admits to being in the IRA or not. To see him, he's in his early 20s at this point, and a gaggle of small kids around him, and he's showing them guns and bullets and everything. It's not a great look, is it?
Well, what's even more remarkable is the apparent tolerance of people like Mr. McGuinness at that point in time. No mask, no hood or anything. This is in broad daylight. And similarly, when the bomb has been prepared, there you see the figure of Martin McGuinness with his coat. He's not physically doing anything, but he's moving around the vehicle at the back of the vehicle. So like you know, if you're a family who's lost a loved one in that part of the world, naturally you're going to be very concerned and shocked about it. But what I'm saying, what is really dominating the news, is this charge against Mr. Paisley, which Mrs. Paisley categorically rejects. Peter Robinson rejects. Ian Paisley Jr., in fact, referred to the filthy reporting that involved
scum,
in this year.
The word scum was used, I believe.
The language is quite strong from Ian Paisley, particularly Ian Paisley Jr., against the BBC. Now, this is the problem when it comes to programmes like this. There's testament and testimony. Now, Sir Michael Carver, who was the senior man of the army at the time, he at one stage specifically writes in a text, the option seems to me to be to escape from the border, because he believed the IRA were on the way up and the army were on the way down, and he didn't seem to see a resolution. So he was talking, we must escape from Ireland.
And he talks about a plebiscite.
That's in writing. That's testament. It's like making your own will. That's his testament of that time. This other stuff, testimony, that's the dilemma.
Eamon, to go back to that document for a minute. So what he was suggesting there, and he was the senior man in the British Army in place at the time, was he suggesting, in layman's language, we need to get out of here, we need to have a plebiscite of some kind, and what, with a view to a united Ireland, isn't that the British would withdraw completely from the situation?
That seems to be the implication of what he's saying in that. I mean, this all happened on passing very quickly as the programme moved on, and I haven't had a chance to revisit. But the document is published. It's been up there on social media, the content of what he was saying. But you find the senior officer also recommending that the parish should cool off and particularly be very careful how they're dealing with young Catholics, etc. And of course, a bloody Sunday then followed. So there are so many lessons running through this from the very mouths of the British themselves. And that I know the programme is rather sort of in the spotlight, euphemistically, because of this allegation against Ian Paisley.
Eamon, there's a second allegation against Ian Paisley as well, am I right? Which is made on camera by Austin Currie.
No, that is untrue. I have to be very specific about that.
Okay.
It's not on camera, and I don't even think we should discuss it, because it's part of a narrative, and I think I prefer to leave that, because, again, it's somebody told somebody, whereas when you see a document, as a researcher, academic historian, historians love to see the document. What did he write down? Unfortunately, with a charge against Ian Paisley, there's nothing written down, whereas the document and the remarks of Sir Michael Glover, the senior officer in the British Army, it's written down. We see Martin McGuinness in the car. We see Martin McGuinness behind the vehicle, which is perceived to be the one that was responsible for the Ship Quay bombing. That's the distinction I would draw.
Okay, Eamon, I want to bring in John Bruton.
Well, it appears to me from what Eamon is saying that the charge against Ian Paisley is based entirely on hearsay evidence. There's no direct evidence. There's nobody saying that he had direct knowledge of this. There's somebody quoting someone else. And that wouldn't be admitted in a court of law. You couldn't sustain a charge in a court of law on that basis. And in any event, Dr. Paisley is dead and not in a position to defend himself.
And you see, there is, I have noticed a sense among a lot of people that the papers have tried to shake out to talk about this. Is there a sense, Eamon, that a lot of people think, well, look, they're both dead, and what good is it going to do to drag any of this up anyway?
Well, this is a theme, and I made the point on BBC Radio also the other day. That is a common theme, particularly among mothers. I hear mothers, an awful lot of mothers saying, just forget about the past, draw a line in the sand. That is fine, and I understand that approach in a way. But if you're a family, if you are the family of a loved one who was disappeared, if your husband was a UDR man and you have an empty chair every single night at that table, it's not that easy to say, forget about it. There are people and they want to know, how was my husband killed? What were his last words? What were the circumstances? There is no easy solution to this. Fortunately, I lived in Northern Ireland all during that, most of the trouble. Now, I didn't lose any member of my family. I cannot put myself in the position of somebody who lost a member of the family. Mm-hmm. I interviewed scores of those people. I know scores of those people who are still heartbroken, who haven't recovered.
Do you think it would... Nobody died, as I understand it, in the bomb that Martin McGuinness was involved in. Do you think... Would some people have difficulty with the legacy that we now have of well, Ian Paisley, okay, we're saying that's a less cut and dried situation. The legacy of Martin McGuinness now as peacemaker and as one half of the Chuckle Brothers and all that, whereas this stuff like this never came out while he was alive.
Well, listen, there will always be people who would have seen Martin McGuinness as part of a killer organisation. They're not going to change their views. But the evolution of McGuinness, his admission that he was in the IRA, that he was an operator, that he was active, that definitely diminished how people saw him in terms of the figure, the demonic figure. That definitely changed. He ended up extraordinarily well-received in the Protestant Unionist community at many, many levels in that community because I think he admitted he had a past.
Okay. Eamon, thanks very much. And I should say that obviously the BBC stand over the editorial content of that documentary, absolutely. It's called Spotlight on the Troubles, A Secret History, and it will be broadcast on BBC One Northern Ireland and BBC Four next Tuesday at 8:30 p.m. Thank you very much, Eamon Malley, and we'll take a break.
The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Tesco Club Card, helping you save more every time you shop. Tesco, every little helps.
Welcome back. John Bruton, Sinead O'Carroll, Jim Power still with us. And so is Suzanne Lynch, Washington correspondent of the Irish Times. And Suzanne, I thought we'd have a little catch up about yes. Matters American. So you're based in Washington, obviously. Yeah. You were home covering the Pence visit.
That's right.
Last week. What were your thoughts on it?
Well, look, I think it started off all very well. And by the end of it, I think a lot of people were happy to see the back of Mike Pence. I mean, firstly, the timing proved interesting for the government because Mike Pence had originally supposed to be visiting London first and then coming to Ireland. And this was seen as a kind of a potential difficulty for Ireland because it was assumed that he would meet Boris Johnson. He would get the British side of things on Brexit and then come to Ireland. So when the timetable was changed and Mike Pence was coming first, there was kind of quiet smiles in Dublin because, you know, they could speak and brief Mike Pence on the Irish perspective on Brexit. But what actually happened was there were 2 days of visits. And on the first day, he had a media event with Simon Coveney down in Shannon. And it was all very general. And he seemed to be quite on the Irish side, if you like, when it comes to Brexit. But something evidently happened in over 12 hours or so, because when he delivered his pre-scripted comments on Brexit alongside the Taoiseach,
delivered off an autocue.
He did. Yeah, I was there. He was reading off an autocue. And he surprised pretty much everyone there by saying, you know, the EU and Ireland must negotiate, come to the table. He talked about the importance of protecting UK sovereignty. So this was not expected. And I think there's a lot of bad feeling that this had happened. Now, in saying that, and Lucinda Creighton makes this point exactly in her piece today in the Sunday Business Post, in one way, you know, we should not be surprised. The Trump administration is unabashedly pro-Brexit. Donald Trump, National Security Advisor John Bolton, they support Brexit. They think it's a good thing. It's in line with their rejection of the notion of multilateralism, the notion that countries should work together. So in a sense, Mike Pence is kind of, you know, supporting that line. And also really, to some extent, it doesn't really matter what Mike Pence thinks on this, because ultimately any trade deal between
Britain and the United States has to go to Congress. And Nancy Pelosi has been unequivocal. She's the head person in the House of Representatives. I spoke to her myself for the Irish Times, and she was unequivocal about this, saying she will block a deal if it doesn't.
Even if this is a red line for Donald Trump, it just can't happen without Congress.
And I looked into
Congress.
This, and if you look back in 2008, there was a trade deal under negotiation between the US and Colombia, and Nancy Pelosi was also the House Speaker back then. She had a long career, and she blocked that. There were different concerns, obviously. There were concerns about human rights and labour standards. She used a kind of little-known clause in the legalities around trade to block that, and it was delayed. Now, it did eventually happen, but by many years later than they thought.
Okay.
So I think there's kind of a denial on the British side that Congress has such power over these trade deals, because a trade deal between Britain and the United States is one of the key, you know, talking points of Brexiteers. They, of course, want to leave the European Union, so they'll sign trade deals with other countries. But, of course, Donald Trump, as we know, is all talk on a lot of these issues.
And he can be a fickle friend.
Yes, he says, I want to sign a trade deal. But, of course, in his terms, look what happened with Denmark, look what happened with other countries. Once they say, well, actually, we want this from the relationship, he says, well, then, sorry, it's not happening.
Yeah, because he views a trade deal as something that he wins.
America,
it's a zero-sum game. And
yeah,
the more you get, the less we're getting, and that's not...
Yeah, and so the two issues that are difficult for Britain will be agriculture, kind of what we were talking about, and they've different standards on chicken and different meats. And secondly, America wants access to the NHS and other contracts to compete for, you know, UK government contracts. And this is a no-no for much of the British public. So that's a real difficulty.
Except that, as I understand it, the private contractors can go for NHS contracts and do all the time. And I'm not sure they have to be British. But anyway, the other aspect of the Pence visit that has this taken off as a serious issue in America, the notion that Pence stayed at Doomsday?
Yeah, it really has. Usually in America, there's quite a brief coverage, A, of Mike Pence's trips abroad, because he is only the vice president, and B, you know, to countries, you know, European countries, that's relatively uncontentious. This time it was different. There was a travelling pool of reporters who were speaking to there in Farmley, and from the get-go, there was concern about why Mike Pence was staying at Doombeg, that's owned by Donald Trump, the hotel there. And we do need to remember, this is coming at a specific time, because in the last few weeks, Donald Trump got himself into hot water for suggesting that next year's G7 summit, which is due to take place in America, should take place in the Trump Hotel in Miami. So he's already...
Is this Mar-a-Lago?
It's not Mar-a-Lago. No. He's other properties in Florida.
Right.
So this was suggested, and of course, out of the entire United States. So there's already a lot of media scrutiny over this. There's an issue constantly, and there's been court cases about this that are ongoing. The Trump Hotel in Washington is just located a few blocks from the White House, and this is frequented, obviously, by a lot of Trump supporters, but also foreign dignitaries. Different countries send their officials to stay in that hotel, and other businesses, essentially, in Maryland and nearby states have taken cases against this, saying that Donald Trump is in breach of there's a clause in the US Constitution that prohibits presidents from taking gifts, it's called the Emoluments Clause, from other countries. So there's a lot of focus on this.
Is this another way of this Democratic obsession with, instead of focusing on beating Donald Trump in an election, this obsession with throwing all these arrows at him and none of them seem to do the job in the end?
Yeah, I mean, what's probably more interesting in this instance of Mike Pence is that there have been suggestions of tension between Donald Trump and Mike Pence. Obviously, there's been a huge churn of personnel in the White House, but Mike Pence has successfully managed to
keep smiling in the background.
Yeah. He's kept happy, he's happy smiling face at the background of a lot of these very contentious issues. But Trump has been happy to keep him on board. It's quite obvious, really, because Mike Pence is such an in with the kind of conservative evangelical vote. But there were mumblings, it's funny, in the last few weeks that would Donald Trump pick him as a running mate, etc. Now, it looks like he still will in 2020. But significantly, Donald Trump specifically contradicted Mike Pence's chief of staff. He told reporters travelling with Pence from Doonbeg up here to Dublin that Donald Trump had kind of suggested he stay in the hotel. He hadn't directed it, but he suggested. So Donald Trump himself was asked about this in the Oval Office, and he shot that down. So there are definitely signs of tension between these two men, and that's something maybe to watch in the next few months. So I think that's part of the significance of this story.
Okay, now, the Donald Trump summer, has it been a good summer, bad summer for him?
Not particularly. I mean, it's a real back-to-school feel in Washington. I'm going back early this week myself. And no, it hasn't been good, particularly for Donald Trump. His performance, I think, at Biarritz at the G7 was particularly erratic, even by Donald Trump's standards. You know, he was threatening trade action, in particular against France, changing his stance on China, and his comments towards Denmark and his decision to cancel that trip over Greenland was also seen as very kind of erratic. But I think most concerning for Donald Trump is the economy. Mm-hmm. Few economic headwinds now in the US, mainly down to his own trade policy. I mean, there's very serious stakes here. China and the United States are the two biggest economies in the world, and they're engaged in a trade war, essentially. That's getting more serious by the minute. Now, there are talks that the two sides are going to come back at a more senior level and talk, but this is beginning to affect not only like farmers, we're talking about farmers here, but farmers in America, producers in the Midwest, really are getting affected by these. And the Trump administration has essentially given them a bailout. There was another $16 billion bailout for these farmers recently.
You would have thought that the most important thing for Donald Trump now is to hold off any kind of a recession until after he gets re-elected in 2020. But yet this China trade war could cause a recession.
Yeah, and we might see him step back from the brink and some kind of deal coming now, because you're right, this is something that Donald Trump does worry about. He worries about the stock market. He talks up the economy all the time. And if there is any suggestion that that's beginning to turn, that could be a vulnerability for him next year in the elections. In saying that, there'll be some recent polls that show that maybe in this case, that the economy will not weigh on voters' minds the way it has in previous elections.
Okay.
Because Donald Trump himself is such a divisive figure that he is motivating people to either vote for him or vote against him next year. That, you know, it's all become about Trump now. And even if they have misgivings, say, on the Republican side of the economy, they'll still vote for him because they like what he's doing on the Supreme Court and social issues, and they like their man, and they're going to fight for him.
So Trumpism, And how are the Democrats getting on with their race?
Well, that's entering a new stage this week. So on Thursday, the third Democratic debate, televised debate, is taking place in Texas, and the field is narrowing. There were more than 20 candidates. That's narrowing. Now 10 candidates have qualified, and they will debate on Thursday. Now, other candidates are still in the race, but it's really, you know, minnowing down now to this smaller group. Joe Biden, again, hasn't had a great summer. He's the front runner, but he he's still ahead in the polls. This is Joe Biden, the former vice president under Barack Obama. He has a lot of vulnerabilities, number one being his age, and two, his stance on various controversial issues like race and gender in his very long political career. And his supporters, I think, now are worried that these have emerged as major vulnerabilities for him. Now, there was a poll out in the last 12 hours or so that shows he's ahead, but only at 29% among Democratic voters. So it's not a huge lead. And then, you know, up behind him are Bernie Sanders, who's still there, and Elizabeth Warren. She is definitely the one to watch at the moment. She's a senator from Massachusetts. She made her name by really taking on the bank. She's a Harvard professor who was once a real capitalist and then kind of changed her policy position. And I've been speaking to people in the States who say one of her advantages is that she can communicate with ordinary working class voters. She's got that folksy appeal, grew up in Oklahoma, and it's kind of connecting with people, particularly in the early voting states like Iowa and New Hampshire. She's doing very, very well there.
Okay.
So at the moment, I think, you know, she's on the up, but again, it's a long way out. Anything could happen in the next few months.
All right, thanks, Suzanne. John Bruton, going back to the start of what Suzanne was saying there about the relationship between Ireland and America now, and then you look at the relationship between Ireland and Britain now. I think Jodie Corcoran was alluding to this today in the Sunday Independent, somebody pointing out that compared to the golden days of when we had this great relationship with America, and then the relationship we had built in recent years with Britain, we're kind of a bit on our own now, like, and we're potentially going to be kind of out there on the outskirts of Europe as well.
Yes, and that's not because of anything we have done. It's because of changes in the political climate in the United States and in the United Kingdom. Radical nationalism has gained ground in both of those places. So we're now left depending much more than we would otherwise have done on our relationship with continental Europe and through the European Union. And the European Union solidarity for us is going to be much, much more important in the future, I think, than it has been in the past. Now, the fact that we may not have an ideal relationship with President Trump does not mean that we don't have a good relationship with American business. American business continues to invest heavily in this country and see it as a good proposition. As far as our relationship with Britain is concerned, yes, there's differences around the details of the Brexit negotiation. But the fact is we are condemned to live together because we're in part sharing the same island.
As Mugabe said about the whites in Zimbabwe, we cannot deny the love that exists between us, isn't it? That's pretty much
with the history anyway.
Well, one issue, sorry, just one issue on that. I mean, there are problems with that for Ireland because, for example, even though we are going to be inevitably brought more, you know, into solidarity with Europe, as you say, some of the developments in Europe are not all good for Ireland. Right. For example, the clampdown on corporate tax, like, you know, if that's going to be an issue that will resurge for us, greater, you know, greater federalist Europe, more concentration, more, you know.
I think the truth of the matter is we have succeeded, and I was involved in this myself in the convention, in retaining unanimity on tax matters. And any issue on corporate tax is going to be dealt with through the OECD with American involvement, not just exclusively by the European Union. I think we're going to have to give some ground will be given on this, but it's not going to be dramatic.
But the OECD are changing their position a bit on this as well, talking about minimum corporate tax rates. So it's not that that's going to be an easier path necessarily.
And we keep being told there will be some payback for all this support we're getting from our friends.
I was just going to go back to the point because you brought up Mugabe again and not being shocked by what Mike Pence said off AutoCue, because Donald Trump's administration has changed how foreign diplomacy is done there. So instead of the words we heard from our 1983 diplomats was that it was couched with carefulness. Nothing that Donald Trump does with his international partners is couched with carefulness. So that's why we're not
couched
surprised.
With coarseness now, I think is the new mantra. Jim, briefly.
Oh yeah, I just think at a global level, what's happening at the moment is deeply disturbing. I mean, Ireland may be becoming more isolated because of its relationship with Britain and the United States. But if you look at the rise of China, the menace of North Korea, what's happening in the Middle East, what's happening in North Africa, there was never a time, I think, in recent history when the world, the Western world, needed to be more united. And it is becoming more disjointed. Because if you look across Europe, you know, you look at the rise of the right in Italy and Germany and Hungary and Poland and Austria, Europe is becoming, at a political level, much more fragmented. And then Trump is... you know, creating
but
major
you know what?
Problems.
Emmanuel Macron is going to save us all and bring the whole world together.
Yes.
Okay, listen, John Bruton, you're going to leave us now, so thank you very much, and we'll take a break.
Podcast The Marian Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
Welcome back. Suzanne Lynch, Jim Power and Sinead O'Carroll still with us. A texter there saying, Sinead O'Carroll was doing so well until she predicted a draw in the Camogie final today. Han Galway! But we are joined now by Owen Sweeney. So earlier this week, the singer Justin Bieber opened up about his struggles with drugs and depression, and he puts it all down to being a child star. So he says at the age of 13, he was just a small town boy, suddenly went to international superstar, and he says this is the root cause of all his problems. So producer Owen Sweeney is going to talk to us about some child stars who suffered and indeed the ones who survived their childhood stardom. Owen, we find the whole child star arc fascinating, don't we?
Yes, because I suppose we all have our favourite child stars when we were children or young people and we looked up to them, and everyone's got film stars or TV, and they seem to be on a massive conveyor belt at the moment as kind of television, and as someone who used to work in young people's television tries to keep up with and tries to keep the attention of young people watching. The child stars are getting younger and younger. We've gone from teens to tweens to what? God knows what now. So, and also it defines these people in our imagination.
Yeah.
You know, it is that thing. Arnold from Different Strokes will always be Arnold. Gary Coleman will always be that kid if you were that generation.
Yeah,
I was watching
it's
the
true,
80s.
Isn't it? There's a kind of a common set of themes here and things that happen? What are the kinds of reasons they go off the rails? Do we blame the parents?
Well, you can often blame the parents because sometimes you do have stage parents and, you know, and often, and it's nothing new as well, going back through the annals of Hollywood, sometimes the parents help themselves a little too liberally to the child's income, shall we say, and then when it all disappears, sometimes the entire family can fall apart as a result. Child actors are replaceable. There's a high premium on cuteness, if I can put that in inverted commas, as Hollywood has seen it. Okay. See it. And, you know, as soon as puberty hits, invariably, if you're a preteen star, your career is, you know...
Oh, really, yeah.
It can be in trouble. Okay. Very few people survive this. You know, Jodie Foster is one of the prime examples, I suppose, but very few people kind of go on to have long careers, particularly in Hollywood. Money is management, as I say. Parents, it's a great Billy Ray Cyrus quote, actually, but Miley Cyrus, of course, was a Hannah Montana, a Disney star, and now has gone on to a very mega stardom in pop. He kind of said at one point, look, sure, I'm not even her parent anymore, I don't think. There's this machine around her, yeah, you know, on the red carpet and whatever, who are bringing her from thing to thing, and kind of he's like, you know, he sees her at holidays or whatever. So in some ways, you can have stage parents being too pushy, and in other cases, they could just kind of find themselves pushed to the margins, people are making decisions for them. I suppose kids are kind of, you know, they often rebel because, you know, in Disney and Nickelodeon, you have to be so pure. You have to be whiter than white. So you're kind of repressing, you know, what might be your own personality, particularly in adolescence. And so you kind of, if 18 comes along and you've got loads of money and you're no longer kind of on Disney Channel every day of the week, then you can go a bit mad in public.
Tattoos and the rest of it.
Tattoos and drink and whatever.
So just briefly on Justin Bieber and then we'll move on to some others. But Justin Bieber, I believe the way you do it nowadays is you write your confession in the notes app on your iPhone.
Yes.
And then you take a screenshot of that and post it to Instagram. What were Justin Bieber's problems?
Well, Justin Bieber blamed it all, I suppose, as you said in your intro there. He was 13 when he was discovered. He was kind of small town Ontario in Canada. And he was discovered by Scooter Braun and then became this kind of, you know, he was a bit of a YouTube thing and then he became a megastar, and he's had untold hits, you know, around the world. People couldn't even start to enumerate. But of course, and this is a part of it as well, and Mara Wilson, who was Matilda, who's written a very, very good book on all of this and kind of surviving child stardom, and she's brilliant on Twitter, and I heartily recommend you check her out and read the book.
She came good, did she?
She came good. Yeah, she kind of just said, that's it, I'm done, you know, whatever, I'm not the Q kid anymore. She went to NYU and she's now writing and telling. She's a storyteller, she says herself, but she's very good on Twitter and she's very good on this subject. But one of the things that she says, Justin Bieber says, is, you know, they didn't know how to make decisions for themselves, and also they were told at every second of every day, because they're a cash cow, going back to Billy Ray Cyrus, kind of the machine around Miley, there's a lot of people's incomes on this. So he was told he was great every single part of every day, from, you know, from when he woke up to when he went to bed. He was pampered. He didn't know how to live his own life. He didn't know how to make decisions. And it's funny, when he started kind of publicly going off the rails, he was 19. It was at that kind of cusp again.
The monkey.
You know, the monkey. And it's true.
Remind us of the monkey.
Brendan, you could do many, many things in public and in the world as a famous person, but if you're seen as mistreating an animal, it is almost...
What happened with the monkey?
One of the worst things you can do. He was trying to get a monkey, his pet monkey, whose name escapes me, I have to confess, into Germany. And it was confiscated at customs in Munich. And that was fine, became very public furore, etc., etc., etc. But he never went back for the monkey. The monkey then went to a local zoo, and Justin Bieber's kind of started becoming this bad boy then. Which I suppose he kind of wanted to rebel, but he was seen as this uncaring character. And as he says in his own Instagram post, he became the most hated person in the world. It was probably overstating it a little. But, you know, people are always, and the other thing with child stars is schadenfreude, people are always looking for the fall from grace.
Yeah. You know? And it turns out he was taking very heavy drugs.
He was taking a lot of drugs. We knew that. And kind of, you know, he was speeding. And there was a lot of this plays out in social media and TMZ. In Hollywood as well. Yeah. It's kind of, you know, this network of what would you call rubbernecking of celebrities, you know, this, and it run by a lawyer of all people. Well, I suppose best person to run a kind of gossipy website. But, you know, they're feeding off this. You know, this is the machine. Yeah. This is the internet clicks.
And we should say that Justin Bieber, now a married old man of 25. And it's all
Hailey Baldwin. He credits his faith. I shouldn't just give it all to God. And he credits his wife and he credits his family.
By the way, I'm told that Justin Bieber's monkey was called O.G. Mally. And apparently, and I quote, still has abandonment issues.
Also, child stars suffer from major abandonment issues as well. Corey Feldman being one of them.
Okay, so tell us about we can't mention Corey Feldman without mentioning Corey Haim. Let's talk about the two Corys.
We're speaking to our generation now. Yeah, I mean, people remember from The Lost Boys, and the two of them, and people will remember Corey Feldman from The Goonies and other movies like that. The two of them kind of go side by side for 80s kids, and then it all kind of went a bit wrong for both of them, actually. They both got into very, very serious drugs. Corey Feldman had to emancipate himself from his parents. Another theme that happens. Do you remember? I mean, Macaulay Culkin had something similar going on in his life. Lindsay Lohan has major issues with her dad as well. Britney Spears' dad is her conservator, now this week is trying to get away from that role as well. But the two, Corey Haim died tragically in 2010, kind of at the age of 38. He had serious substance abuse problems. Again, as kind of a teen star heartthrob in 1988, whenever The Lost Boys came out, trying to transition into adult roles. Also, you're living in Hollywood. Everybody loves you. Everyone's throwing money at you. You're going to all the clubs. You're hanging out with River Phoenix and Johnny Depp and whatever. You know, River Phoenix, who is also no longer with us. Drugs are freely available, but you're a liability. Who's going to hire you? Do you know, if you're seen as this sort of kind of wayward youth, that rebel image is great, but, you know, it's not very bankable, and you burn through your money very, very fast. If you have any, if your parents haven't already taken it, which happened in a lot of places. In fact, Jackie Coogan, can I go back to the 1930s very quickly?
Coogan, I want to get back to Corey Feldman as well, your other Corey. Who's our thread?
Jackie Coogan, very quickly, because the Californian Child Actress Bill is known as the Coogan Bill. Right. His parents basically stole all his money, or his mother, or say his dad said, his mother and his stepfather, who was his accountant slash manager, stole $4 million. Dollars in the 1930s from him. He was the kid in the Charlie Chaplin movie, The Kid. He was a massive star.
Wow.
And he stole $4 million, which was a huge amount, probably about 40, 50 million in the 1930s. So they robbed all that of him, and he got a very small portion of it. Now, there's now a child actor's bill named after him in California, best place for it, which guarantees a portion of any child actor's earnings will be maintained until they reach adulthood, etc., etc., etc. He went on to be Uncle Fester in the original Addams Family.
Really? So he made the money back.
He made a bit of money back.
Some of it,
but Corey Feldman's another one. You're right, the two Coreys, it's funny, they kind of became this kind of this double act, and they appeared in reality TV shows as well until, unfortunately, Corey Haim's demise. But Corey Feldman emancipated himself from his parents, as I said, also was a heroin user. He was arrested for heroin possession twice, do you know? And this guy was kind of the brightest shining star. He has made very serious allegations of paedophilia in Hollywood as well around the time of they were coming up.
And he says he blames Corey Haim's kind of messy life.
Yeah, absolutely.
That.
And I think it affects you if you watch these people as a kid, because kind of you have a bond with these people in movies, and you watch what happens to them, and you kind of think as a kid you'd love to be famous, you'd love to be a Hollywood movie star and all this sort of stuff, and you watch what happens to some of them. And yeah, Corey Feldman has laid those very serious allegations. And, you know, there's, I'm sure, you know, plenty of credence given to them in many circles, but nothing has happened and come of it. However, he was pals with Michael Jackson, and he says Michael Jackson now never did anything untoward with him, but his real issue with Michael Jackson was, you know, wants to be, and there's this footage of him and wants to be his pal and everything else when he was the star. But then, you know, he became whatever, 13, 14, someone else came along who was the latest young wunderkind, and he abandoned him, and he wasn't returning his calls. He didn't want anything to do with them anymore. So that was a huge psychological effect on him.
And Michael Jackson, funnily enough, comes up in more than one of these stories. So you mentioned Macaulay Culkin there a minute ago. Another pal of Michael Jackson's. Tell us about Macaulay.
Well, Macaulay Culkin's interesting. He was the first child actor to be paid $1 million for a movie, which is for My Girl, you know, the follow-up to the movie he did after Home Alone. Macaulay Culkin's thing brings in this whole family. He's two brothers, Kieran and Rory, who are still acting nowadays.
And one of them brilliant in Succession.
In Succession,
at the moment.
That's right. And Macaulay's manager, and this is another thing about child actors again, his dad, Kit, became his agent. And in one poll, and I think it was 1993 or thereabouts, he was named, Kit Culkin was named the 48th or whatever most powerful man in Hollywood, a person in Hollywood. And you know, if you wanted Macaulay Culkin, you had to go through the dad. The dad obviously was starting to rub people up the wrong way. There's a bit of living vicariously through the kids. Do you know, I don't think we have to be a hugely qualified psychologist to make that kind of leap. And so, and the dad, of course, was a frustrated, I think he was a PR, but I think he was also an amateur actor, wants to be an actor.
Of course.
You know, this does happen. And anyway, Macaulay's success tanked. He's on record as saying to the family, he said, right, I hope you've all made your money, because that's it from me. I'm out of here. Richie Rich was kind of the big budget movie that died a death. Kit Culkin became branded as box office poison in Hollywood. Unfortunately, the Culkin family then kind of fell apart. The parents separated or divorced rather bitterly. But Macaulay Culkin, because you think of him as Kevin McAllister in Home Alone, you think of him as this cherubic young fella doing that, channeling Edvard Munch's The Scream with his hands to his face. And then you see him in New York and, you know, all, you know, he looks gaunt, he looks grown up. Again, you know, we picture them as kids.
How dare he look gaunt
and
grown up?
Well, this is it.
Okay, you've 30 seconds to tell us about what happened to everyone in Different Strokes, because that was an absolute omni-shambles, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Dana Plato, heartbreaking. She was Kimberly. She died of a drug overdose. She signed over. Her mother died when she was young, and she signed over power of attorney to her accountant. He ran off with all her money.
And Arnold, what are you talking about?
Arnold died. Well, he had kidney problems, and he had a lot of personal problems, and he had, you know, various battery charges against him as well, and pestered by fans, etc., etc., etc. Was a security guard at one stage. He also died, but of kidney failure or of, you know, of natural causes.
Owen Sweeney,
thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And to you, I say, there's eternal words of wisdom. The world don't move to the beat of just one drum. What might be right for you may not be right for some. Okay, that's all we've time for today. Thanks to our panel, Sinead O'Carroll, Suzanne Lynch and Jim Power, still with us. Michelle Brown and Andrew Fleming are our researchers. Emily Hurley was our broadcast coordinator. Jamie Doyle was on sound. Penny Hart produced, and the series producer is Margaret Curley. Enjoy the rest of your day, and I'll talk to you soon.
The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Tesco Grocery Home Shopping. If you can't come to us, we'll come to you. Tesco. Every little helps.